Hey folks, welcome back. We are live at TechEd Europe in Barcelona, and this is exciting because we are talking about all things ASP.NET, maybe some Azure, maybe some vNext. It's kind of all open, and just realize again, send us your question, put these guys on the hot seat. I want to see them suffer. That is a request, so we can get some questions going on here. Now, I'm Dan Fernandez. Scott, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Scott Hunter. I work on the ASP.NET team, the Azure SDK team, the Visual Studio web tooling team at Microsoft.
I'm Brady Gaster. I work on the Azure SDK team and the Visual Studio web tools extensions team.
So maybe to kind of kick things off, what are you all talking about at TechEd? I almost said build.
So tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the future of .NET on the server.
Okay.
So that's basically, we're calling that ASP.NET vNext. And that's the reimagining of .NET on the server.
And vNext is a code name, or is that like the official, have you guys stamped the official branding?
vNext is the name until the actual official branding has been released by Microsoft.
Okay,
so
awesome.
I'm waiting for the event.
You dodged the first question. Excellent job. Yes. Okay, you came prepared. So for folks who have been doing ASP.NET development since the 2.0 days, what are the key things? Because it seems like there's some big advancements that maybe they may not even be aware of what this really means to be an ASP.NET developer for vNext.
So we look at this a couple ways. First off, the biggest thing I want to do is I've talked to customers and they're like, oh, I can't move to the latest version of ASP.NET. And I can't move to that version of ASP.NET because I'm running a server that's got .NET 4 on it and I can't put .NET 4.5 on it, or it's got .NET 3.5 on it and I can't put .NET 4 on it. We want to solve that problem. So we're going to basically say that you can ship the .NET framework as part of your ASP.NET application, meaning that it will affect nothing else on the entire machine. You can put this new version of ASP.NET, you can install an app on a machine and have no risk of breaking any other application on the machine at any point in time. And so we hope that's going to get people to actually use the latest features and the latest versions faster than they can today.
Okay.
And that's a big tenet of the new stuff. Another big tenet of the new stuff is we want to make development faster. So if you're in Visual Studio today and you want to go build an MVC application, you make a change to your controller. The compile step inside of Visual Studio is about 7 or 8 seconds between compiling and launching the browser.
Yeah.
We want to get that to sub 1 second.
That's awesome.
And so part of that is we're just not going to do the compilation's not going to, there's not going to be a compilation step.
Mm-hmm.
We're using Roslyn, the new C# and VB compiler.
Yeah.
And it gives us a bunch of benefits where we can actually compile directly to memory. And so we're not actually going to touch the disk anymore. And so when you build one of these apps, we just compile right to memory and run from memory versus running off the disk. And that helps some of that performance. We're doing a ton of optimizations where, like, when you're in VS, VS does a compilation itself, so it can actually show errors in your code.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually going to save that compilation and use that for the runtime.
So how does that work exactly? So when you say you're saving, like I could imagine Roslyn's giving me some, red squigglies or something like that. Underneath the covers, you're saving that? Or what do you mean
exactly?
What
we found is we were actually compiling 3 or 4 times between VS and Control F5 in your application. If you looked at the number of cycles of things that happened, and we start looking at how do we optimize some of those out.
So the idea is to basically don't repeat yourself compiler.
Exactly.
Okay.
Compile yourself once, not compile yourself 4 to 5 times.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And so that's, once again, people always ask questions like, there's been points in time where we worried about startup time. There's been points in time we worried about performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when you start focusing on an area do you go and optimize these things out. If that scenario has never been high on your list, how fast does Control F5 happen? What's an area that we just haven't looked at?
Right.
And so now we're being way more hardcore and looking at how we can shave that down. And really, I want the public preview that we're going to ship in a few weeks won't have all the optimizations in. But by the time we RTM, I expect to have all the optimizations in. And I really think you should be able to save a file, go to your browser, refresh, and get a sub 1 second or a 1 second time frame for that to refresh.
So for a lot of ASP.NET developers, that's crazy talk, right? Because a lot of times they would, whether it's running their own script or do something, they'd kind of NGen or warm up, do the pre-compilation step, maybe in WebDeploy, which has some of these features.
Yep.
Like, Did they just not need to do that anymore? And it's just it just seems so unfathomable, maybe? Like, there's no DLL on disk then, for example?
There's no DLL on disk.
So
You can put a DLL on disk. We have command line tools that will actually put DLLs on disk for you if you want the DLLs on disk.
And is that like for legacy, like, hey, I need to use XYZ component, or is that just
that can be for
the people that do want to pre-compile?
It's for if you want to deploy. So if you want to deploy and have something pre-compiled when you deploy, we can basically build your stuff down into a NuGet package, and we'll actually deploy NuGet packages as part of this.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So the deployment's not DLLs in this case. It's pretty much every unit of compilation in our world now is a package. So when you bring in the framework, if you go look in the references node, we no longer show DLLs in the references node. The references node in a ASP.NET VNext project shows you a series of packages. And that's pretty cool. It'll show like MVC as a package.
Right.
It'll show the framework as a package. And if you can actually drill down, if you open the expansions, you can drill all the way down to basically the core framework.
Okay.
But everything is a package, and when we build and deploy an app, we actually compile things back into package. Your app goes into a package. We have a command that actually makes a package of your application, which we would then upload to the server.
So when you said the ability for somebody to package like a 4.5, then 4.5.1, and do this side by side, is that also part of the packaging technology,
or is that separate? One of the packages does contain what we call core CLR,
okay,
which is a subset of the full .NET framework. It doesn't contain, it's basically a base layer. Imagine if you don't have WPF and WinForms and a bunch of display technologies, which for a server, an ASP.NET application, you don't need those technologies anyway. So it's just a base. And the hope is that instead of actually making the base big again, we build everything on top of the base using NuGet packages.
Okay.
So let's keep the base of .NET as small as possible, and then bring every technology in as packages.
Yeah, the reason I like that is because it's pay as you go. So if you really can do something pretty light, you're only paying for a couple of NuGet packages.
Exactly.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's one of the ideas.
We do have questions, which is always exciting. So I think that's John asks, what is the future like for WCF, Windows Communication Foundation?
Yes.
So
we were actually just talking to a customer.
I guess that's Brady.
Oh, I can take it. We were actually just talking to a customer who has a pretty awesome product built on top of WCF. And as we were looking at it, he was just telling us that basically all of his enterprises are still using it. And we know that there are a lot of enterprises out there that are going to use WCF, still using WCF. One of the things that you can do in Service Bus is actually use the remoting binding. So we're actually making that investment to make WCF and Service Bus work together. In terms of the future, you want to go talk about the future? Because I'm not clear on some of the details.
I can talk about the future. I have customers come to me all the time and ask, hey, I'm using WCF. What's going to be the next version of WCF? And I like to turn that question around and say, what do you think should be in the next version of WCF? And they're like, well, it pretty much does everything that I want. In .NET 4.5, we added WebSocket support to WCF.
Mm.
I would not be surprised to see us add support for things like HTTP2 for WCF. So basically, as new technologies emerge in the networking stacks and protocols and stuff like that, we will continue to invest in WCF and bring it those features. Mm-hmm. But we do see WCF as a different framework than something like ASP.NET Web API.
Right.
We see them at different ends of the scale. ASP.NET Web API is trying to be the minimalistic, I want to build REST with the least amount of stuff possible. While WCF has support for SOAP, support for REST, support for some really serious authentication models, it's got
all the WS Star
family. WS Star stuff.
Right.
And so I say use the technology that fits what you're trying to build.
Okay.
If you're trying to build a very lightweight REST service, then I think ASP.NET Web API is the best place for you.
Yeah.
If you've got a bunch of enterprise stuff that's talking to mainframes or just a bunch of enterprise stuff talking behind the scenes to other servers, WCF is great for that, and we still support it, and we'll continue to add features as appropriate.
Okay. So some more questions here. Mads,
wonder who that could be.
Will there be a version of system.web.optimization for VNext?
So right now, we don't plan to do a version of system web optimization for VNext, and I can explain why.
Maybe for folks who don't
know
system. Perfect.
System web optimization is something we started shipping a cycle or two ago. I think Visual Studio 2012 was probably the first time we shipped it. And the goal of it was we were looking at some of the websites that our customers were creating. In fact, the website I laugh about the most is we were looking at www.asp.net. And looking at that site, I'm like, the performance of the site was not great. We're looking at the number of files that are served. And it's like there's a ton of files served. I think it was 65 files served.
Okay.
Well, that's not good for your browser. If your browser has to make 65 requests to the site, your performance is not going to be very good. So system web optimization is something we built that allows you to create what we call bundles. So I can create a bundle of CSS files or a bundle of JavaScript files. We take all those things, merge them together, minify them, compress them, and shoot them down the wire.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a runtime feature today. So when you actually run your ASP.NET application and somebody requests one of these files the first time, a bundle, we actually go and do all the work on the runtime. So in vNext, we've been looking at all the tools that web developers use. And we ran into a bunch of tools like Grunt, Gulp, that are used to run post-processing and pre-processing processes on when they're building web apps.
Right.
And there's a great pile of linters for looking at errors in your JavaScript and your CSS. There's some great tools for compressing and minifying files. And so for vNext, we're going to use those kinds of tools to do the same thing that System Web Optimization does. This means that when you save a file on disk, we'll go run some grunt tasks in the background, and they'll take your file. So if you save one of your CSS files, we'll go run the grunt task in the background, minify it, and build a minified version of it.
So by default, I think, and this goes back to like what's kind of on by default, because this is probably, it's always interesting hearing you guys do the debate of, well, should that be the default or not the default, and how do we make the smart default? Because bundled config, I think, is in default on ASP.NET MVC when you're bundling stuff. So are you thinking now there's going to be a grunt task that happens as a post-compile step? Or
there will be. So in vNext, We've added full support for Grunt and Gulp and stuff in VS. And the plan is it will be there running tasks as you save files, as you do builds. The cool thing about it, if you don't care about Grunt, you're not even going to see it. It'll be out of the way. Only if you care about Grunt, you can actually right-click on a Grunt file, and we've got a cool console that'll open up, and you can actually see the files running.
Right.
You can actually decide which tasks inside of your Grunt file run based on which events happen in VS. So for example, you can do one on project load. You can do one when a file is saved. Well, you can on project load, you might start a watcher. Mm-hmm. And the watch would then actually notice when files change. You can do one on build. So we'll wire those up for you automatically. And so they'll just kind of run for you, and you won't have to worry about them. So it's a pretty cool tool from the standpoint that if you just want things to work, they'll just work out of the box. If you want to get down and dirty and write your own grunt task or modify the grunt task, you can. But we're going to hide that out of the way, so you only have to get there if you care to get there.
Oh, that's great. So
best of both worlds.
We got more questions, which is great. So Ravi Tavar asks, how is the future of ASP.NET web forms over simple HTML5 pages? So how do you all see the future when you're using web forms versus maybe a spa single page app? Mm-hmm. And how do they compare and contrast?
Well, the funny thing about the future of web forms is, if you look at all of our web technologies today, MVC, Web API, Web Forms is technically the fastest technology we have. People never think that. They're always like, oh, yeah, MVC is going to be faster. But actually, Web Forms is a couple percent, like 2 or 3% faster than
any
technology that
That's
we build.
That's great. That's great.
They're all based on top of the same engine, and so they're roughly equivalent. But in the future, we're doing it for the spa types apps. We're doing something that kind of is web formy, but is not full web formy. Angular JS has this really cool feature called directives. And with the directive, what you can actually do is you can write regular HTML, but what Angular does is goes, oh, I'm going to change that HTML a little bit. And so what we're going to do for these spa type apps is we have a feature called, it's currently called tag helpers internally. I don't know what it'll be called once it's public. But with tag helpers, we let you actually take existing elements and override them. And I'll explain why that's important. Let's say you're a web forms developer and you're using controls, like a button control.
Right.
Well, inside of the control, you're not going to get all the fancy HTML IntelliSense because you're actually in the C# world. As soon as you hit that control, you're in C#.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal now is going to be to let you actually write HTML, but we're going to have the ability to override the HTML. Just
okay.
like AngularJS does for directives. So in Angular, if you create a form, behind the scenes, Angular takes that form and writes a little bit of glue to make the Angular stuff work. in our new world, let's say you're going to build a controller-based app. Well, today you would say HTML.beginForm, and you would pass a bunch of C# to it. You would pass anonymous objects for your classes. In the new world, you're just going to say form, just a regular form, but you can actually add attributes to it like action equals and controller equals.
And then behind the scenes,
we will actually override the form and take over that and be able to act on those two extra parameters that you pass to the form. And so the benefit to the customer is you write HTML, we get a chance to actually modify that HTML and do a little post-processing on it before it actually goes out the door. So you get all the IntelliSense you would have in HTML. Your markup looks like HTML, but we can add some extra value to that. So the next step is, if you're doing the spa type app, we'll have a set of these tag helpers that map to MVC. So if you have all the HTML dot text box and all the HTML things that we have in there. But we plan to ship another set of these, which are all around Angular. And we're not going to stop at Angular. It's just one of the ones we're going to do internally.
That's my question. How do you all, because there's so many JavaScript frameworks, like Angular seems to be the hot one. Knockout had this kind of spike. Mm-hmm. Like a jQuery, it's still incredibly popular, even if it's not like seen just maybe from the responsive folks as the best. But how do you all kind of prioritize one versus the other, or say all is hard.
We're looking at popularity right now, and so we're going to take the most popular one, and that's the one that we're going to tool out of the box. But these tag helpers, anybody can write them. You can write them yourself. So the hope is that we get an ecosystem of these things around all the technologies that are out there.
Right.
But with these tag helpers, it means you're going to be able to write a form. It'll look just like an HTML form. But we'll give you a server-side rendering of that form the first time for high performance. And then we'll let the Angular take over on the client for subsequent requests. And so we kind of give you the best of both worlds. And so the hope is that we can help our developers more easily build a SPA-ish type app with the same kind of practices they use today.
Now, have you all thought of doing the kind of going the scaffolding approach today, that people love to kind of use scaffolding to start, where it actually scaffolds out views, but those views are actually just dynamically calling controllers, so it's scaffolds out a SPA, if you will.
We will do that. Yeah. That's also in the plans as well. Not only are we going to have the tag helpers, which are going to let you add some extra logic to the HTML elements, but we plan to actually have, if you want to do a SPA-fied controller, well, then we'll create an Angular controller in the page for you. We'll have it call back to an API controller and write all that logic through for you.
I don't have to write a code anymore. That's fantastic.
And one of the other things, speaking of not having to write code, one of the other things that we've heard a lot from the community and that we've also wanted ourselves, you mentioned scaffolding. It's a project that you and I are actually working on. We're actually investigating the way, if you remember, add service reference or add web reference, we're talking about ways that we could do that for REST services so that we could actually scaffold JavaScript clients. We're just investigating like how we might want to do that. I'd be very interested in hearing what the community has to say about that. Would you prefer to have it in Angular, jQuery, Knockout, or just a list with all of the above? Right now, we're kind of going with option D. We kind of want to give you a list and give you the ability to pick what your backend is and then pick what kind of JavaScript layer you want and just party on it. So hopefully we can get there.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there, but I do want to get to these questions because there is a ton going in here. Slavo asks, can you say more about how VNext relates to IIS, especially about Project Helios?
Yeah, so VNext, we started moving to this Owen approach a year or so ago. And so ASP.NET Web API and ASP.NET SignalR are both based on Owen. And the idea behind Owen was, it allows us to actually replace, right now, if you're using MVC or web forms, those two technologies are highly bolted to IIS.
Right.
And we wanted to give you options outside of just using IIS. And the main scenario for that is a self-host scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you want to have a, let's say, SQL Server. The SQL Server team wants to have a REST endpoint. Do they really want to say that every SQL Server install has to install IIS as well?
Right.
Probably not. And so, for people that want those kinds of workloads, we basically put a layer between ASP.NET and the actual hosting layer, which could be IIS, it could be raw HTTP sys.
Spin up your own.
And that was done in those technologies. And another benefit of that is those two technologies also got off of the main system web pipeline. The main system web pipeline brings some taxes in, and those taxes are, when we first built ASP.NET way back, we were trying to have as much compatibility as we could with classic ASP, or active server pages.
I loved Active Server Pages back in the day, but it's hilarious that, you know, we're sitting here now in 2014, and there's some decision from Classic ASP that still influences
that impacts us. And the impact it has is the HTTP context class, which has your browser,
context,
your response,
all those
massive objects. That means that every request that comes into ASP.NET, we basically boot up 30K of memory.
Oof. Wow. Every request.
Every request. And so Helios, which he was referring to as well, is having a new host that doesn't go through system web.
Okay.
And by hosting on IIS without going through system web, we're saving 30K per request. And under heavy loads, we were doing some testing a couple months ago, it was a 90% reduction in memory usage.
That's amazing.
Which is
great for hosters too that need what's called density, basically the ability to run more and more sites on, you know, the same hardware. Yeah.
So less memory means less garbage collection, less CPU, so it drives the entire cost of everything down,
right,
and it brings our request performance all the way up to Node.js style level. So ASP.NET basically is running as fast as or faster than Node.js.
Nice.
We have a better garbage collector than they do. So.
Yeah, we'll let the .NET Framework team give them some love for the GC work. So a bunch more questions here. Ahmed asks, is there going to be a migration path between current ASP.NET and vNext? So, you know, love the benefits of vNext. What does it mean for I have my existing app? What's the story?
So the story right now is we have two paths on ASP.NET vNext. We support running it on the full .NET Framework that we have today. And we have a smaller version of the framework that's currently called Core CLR. All the marketing names have not been attached yet.
Sure.
If you're actually running the new ASP.NET on the full framework, the compatibility is going to be pretty high for the most part, because all the stuff you're calling is going to be there. What you lose if you go down that path is you're going to lose that ability to run it with the framework as a component of your app, meaning that full side-by-side you'll lose there, but you'll gain the compatibility. We have a bunch of support in the editor that will happen, where we'll actually give you IntelliSense. The IntelliSense, we're calling it combined IntelliSense. It shows you in IntelliSense which methods work and for which frameworks they work on. So it'll tell you, is this available in full framework? Is it available in Core CLR? And so for best compatibility, you can start using the bigger framework first.
Right.
Secondly, we hope to have a tool that'll be available that will at least migrate your project. So
that'd be awesome.
Our project
so like
types,
some sort of analyzer thing.
It'll migrate your projects, it'll fix your references, and it'll clean up some big things. So for example, there's some namespaces that changed and stuff like that.
Mm.
We'll fix those for you. The plan's not to go try to fix your code though. That's out of scope, but it would give you a list of warnings of things that you need to go look at and fix. And so that's probably the level of tooling that we'll have to help you there. But there won't be a magic switch that just makes it happen. That's too hard.
Well, I mean, it's at least good to know. But if somebody had used, at least if their application was using libraries or components, I have to assume those libraries and components, so long as they were compiled for, you know, the right version of the framework, would just work. Like at that point, you're talking at a binary level, right?
The biggest challenges are just going to be the core CLR.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's not there. So for example, if you're doing image resizing today, you're using system.drawing. Which is part of WinForms.
Yeah, which is terrible in and of itself.
Which is also not recommended for server anyways,
because it
tends to fragment the large object heap, which means for a long-running process, it can hurt your memory, it fragments your memory. So there'll be replacements for those things, and that'll be the biggest compatibility issues I think people are going to run into is when something's missing. And we're just going to ask for feedback. If there's something missing that you want that we don't have, let us know. I think it'll take us a couple months after we actually RTM to fill in some of those gaps. And so the nice thing is, you know, we're shipping Visual Studio once a quarter now. My team is shipping ASP.NET and its components pretty much once a quarter as well. And so the velocity is so much faster that if we're missing something, it's not going to take a year or 2 years for that to fill in.
So I wanted to make sure I didn't hear. So is there going to be some replacement for GDI graphics?
We're working on having a replacement for GDI graphics.
Yes. I am incredibly excited. Tell me, is there something more you can share, or just should I just be happy that I got that nugget?
I think you should be happy. There's some great open source projects that are even cross-platform for doing graphic manipulations. And there's somebody that's got a great .NET library that talks to one of those cross-platform libraries.
Okay, I will search NPM tonight. That's
because one of our goals as well is, you know, with ASP.NET vNext is it is cross-platform.
Yes.
So it does run on Linux and Mac and Windows.
That's actually a really good point. Maybe, you know, take a step back. When people think cross-platform, there's the development side, and then there's the runtime side.
You want to kind
of quickly talk about that?
Yeah, so our goal is to, right now we're running ASP.NET vNext on Mono for the cross-platform side.
Mm-hmm.
But the goal is to have most of the stack mainly run on Mac and Linux as well. So if you're building something that targets the core CLR scenario, that's the smaller framework, we're going to make all that stuff, as much of that available as possible on Mac and Linux as well.
It'd be awesome.
And so the goal is, if you're building an app, an ASP.NET app targeting that framework, it should be able to run on Mono on Mac and Linux. And we're going to demo that tomorrow. We're going to actually show ASP.NET vNext on a Mac as part of our session in the morning tomorrow.
There you go.
Oh, and Scott has a pretty enticing demo. You want to tell him about the memory stick demo?
One of my favorite demos on vNext is, which we typically do when we show it, is you build the app in Visual Studio, and then you publish it to a folder on your disk. You copy it to a memory stick, and you go out to the audience and say, who has a laptop I can stick this memory stick in? You stick the memory stick into it. There's a batch file at the root folder of the memory stick, and it will launch the app with nothing being installed on the user's machine at all. No impact on the machine. So
interesting. Yeah. How are you doing the isolation to do that?
Well, remember, everything is in the bin folder. So we don't need anything on the machine to actually run ourselves.
What would a customer like click? Is there like an .exe or something that gets copied over?
There's a batch file at the root of the app. And the batch file at the root of the app will actually launch our test web server that's in the bin folder right on your machine.
Awesome. That's
so
very
cool. It's pretty cool. You go, hey, nothing's installed, no registry, no admin privileges, no nothing, and you can run an app.
Yeah.
Which means also that's the other cool part of this as well is I think it'll get .NET into places it's not been today. You know, today if you want to play with ASP.NET, you got to download a gig and a half of Visual Studio.
Right.
In this world, if you want to work from command line, the download's going to be about 20 megs.
Yeah, I think the other part is that it works on my machine. The whole ability to isolate something, it works on the memory stick.
Yeah. On the memory stick.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be on your, that's the other part.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be true. on your physical machine at all.
Very cool. So tons more questions coming in here. So Nils asks, how much async will be in vNext? I want partial views with async DB requests in MVC.
So this is funny. We actually, I don't know if people recognize this, but if you're using Visual Studio 2013 and you scaffold a controller in MVC, there's actually a checkbox today for doing async database calls already.
Mm-hmm.
So we were waiting for EF to actually have async support, and so EF6 supports await. And so now there's a default checkbox for Web API and MVC already today that will give you async database writes.
Yeah, I actually showed that today. Now this is going back to the conversation on defaults. It's not on by default, meaning a customer has to know to check that. Did you all have a conversation like, when is the right time to have people go?
I think the right time is all the time. Don't be surprised if that becomes the default. It was more of a point in time thing at the time we did it, where it's like, we've been doing it one way for so long, and we want to make it an opt-in.
Right.
But now that we're at the next version, I think it's time to make it the default.
Yeah, it's always funny. Just so people know, like every little decision that's a default, there's at least four PMs that have probably argued it at one time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Next question. Jeremy asks, could we maybe see an update for Web Matrix to bring Monaco to the desktop? Can you speak towards Web Matrix?
Yeah. First off, Web Matrix was a tool we built a couple of years ago. We built it in the VS 2010 timeframe, and the goal honestly was exactly what we were just discussing before, which is how do you get? We were looking at the PHP stacks and the Ruby stacks and how much stuff you had to download to get those running on your machine,
mm-hmm.
and they were like 15 to 20 megs, and we're like, how do we get developer experience on a Windows machine? In that same, using Microsoft technologies in that same footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal with Web Matrix was to get that down to about 50 megs. And we actually did accomplish that in that time frame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It supported .NET. And so if .NET was already, the .NET was already on your machine is what it would use. You could build PHP and Ruby in it, I mean PHP and Node in it as well. Mm-hmm. We shipped version 3 of it about a year ago to support Azure. And I think the next iteration of it will be something that is Monaco-based. I mean, that is the next iteration of that. If you want the lightest tool on your machine, we've got this great Monaco editor, and I don't know if everybody knows about it. If you've ever been to the TypeScript site or if you've gone to the Azure portal mm-hmm. and clicked on a website, there's a checkbox you can enable somewhere in the settings, which will open the enable the Monaco editor. And that's a full editor for doing C# and HTML and CSS and JavaScript. It's all web-based.
Right.
And I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And so I think the long-term plan, or I think one of the goals we have is to get a full editing experience in Monaco for our projects. Now, what's cool with ASP.NET vNext, I don't require a compilation step anymore, which means if you couple my product with an HTML editor, you actually have
a full
running story.
And when it's copied over, like it would basically be like helloworld.cs,
yes.
right? On file, just regular disk. There's no magic, if you will.
Yep, exactly.
And you ever needed to FTP something, it's just FTP in that single CS file. It picks it up, next request, and everything just works.
You got it. Mm-hmm. If you modify a Razor view, you modify a CS file, HTML file, that's all you got to do. Yep. As soon as we see the change on the next request, we'll do the recompilation for you automatically.
So back to the Monaco thing, Brady, did you happen to see the PowerShell, just to put you on the spot, the PowerShell, I think it's Books announcement from the portal, the idea of having some way to do Azure automation directly from the portal using almost like pre-built PowerShell.
Yes, those are called Runbooks.
Thank you.
Yeah, when we were at Build, funny you should mention Build earlier, Joe Levy and I did a presentation and we talked about Azure automation kind of all up. And we talked about the management libraries, which I'll be giving a talk on tomorrow. Then we talked about PowerShell commandlets and the XPLAT CLI tools. And what was nice is that that's the stack. It's MAML, and then on top of MAML is PowerShell, and then on top of PowerShell is the automation service. So if you actually go to the automation widget in the portal, you can go and you can edit PowerShell directly in the browser, and you can just change it all around and write your own runbooks. You can set them up so that they run either on a schedule or when triggered events happen. Joe did a really cool demo where he actually lit one up. He had a runbook that would monitor a website. And whenever the website would go down, he would send a text message through Twilio to the site administrator. And then he starts watching two sites in Azure, and then he stops one. And immediately, one of the audience members gets a text message. So you can do pretty dangerous stuff because it's literally like PowerShell is a service in the cloud. So it's pretty fantastic. They do a lot of good stuff there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and the way it works, where's the PowerShell actually execute? Like in what context? Is it remoting something there? Is it running on Azure?
Well, the PowerShell scripts are actually running on Azure. They have their own instances. So they basically just fan out. They run them in their own. I don't know if they're running an IaaS instance or a cloud service instance. I just don't know what their plumbing looks like.
But there is some level of sandbox, right?
Yes, They totally sandbox it out, and you can only do certain things. You can do a lot more than you would think. One thing that's really nice is all the Azure PowerShell commandlets. That's one of the modules that are basically built into that service by default. One of the other cool demos that he does is he says, let's say you want to turn off our automatic updating and you want to do your automatic updating on your own schedule. You don't want it to come out on Tuesday.
Right.
He actually writes a PowerShell script that will go into each VM in a subscription and update the OS, update all the software, and just mosey on. So it's pretty cool to see that stuff actually in the browser. I think that uses the Monaco editor as well, doesn't it?
I don't know.
I think it does. Not exactly sure.
There's some colorization and execution, so I just assumed.
Yeah.
I would assume as well if it's doing that.
I think it is.
I would hope they're not reinventing
their own.
I'd have
to ask Joe. Joe, if you're watching, let us know if you're using the Monaco editor. So.
Now, is there a way to, you mentioned some of the things like scheduling. Like I could have a web job that says maybe it's run this backup, right? And that backup would then point to a runbook. Is there a way for me within my ASP.NET context to call into?
No, I don't believe so. Web jobs and automation are kind of different. It's sort of like if you look at worker roles was the initial massive processing in Azure, and then the automation service came around right around the time that web jobs was going to come out as well. Now, where web jobs is going to help you is if you've got a web application and you just have a background process that needs to run, you're watching queues or you're doing something along those lines. The automation service is going to be a little bit more lower level, and you'll be able to run PowerShell scripts. However, you could run PowerShell scripts inside of a web job, because web job supports PHP, Node.js, .NET, command files, and PS1 files. So you can kind of pick your poison there. I would say if you're doing a lot of IaaS automation and whatnot, that's where you probably want to look at the automation service, because it does have a little bit more plumbing into it than web jobs does. But
yeah, the best analogy on web jobs is web jobs is the equivalent of worker roles in cloud services for Azure websites.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are familiar with worker roles. I think the one thing they want is that web job, or at least from feedback from customers, is the ability to separate those out, because they do like the loose coupling of, you know, in a queue-centric work pattern where, you know, the ASP.NET site writes to the queue, and then there's this other, you know, scale up, scale down on worker roles based on the amount of messages in a queue.
Right.
So I don't know if that's something that you all are taking feedback on, or I can give you feedback now.
We are taking feedback on. I mean, one of the things, it's too bad Pranav isn't here. Is Pranav here? One of the things that the WebJobs team has in their immediate future is to come up with a not a better way, because they already do a pretty good job of scaling out, because they scale out with the website's instances. Mm-hmm. But they're looking at ways to basically create better parallelism in WebJobs so that, you know, if I've got one site that runs on multiple instances and they're all watching one queue, to be able to more intelligently distribute that workload. That's where the worker roles comes in, because they have, you know, mass scale there. So.
But you can do some of this today. If you take, if you run your website on just one website and you run your web job on a different website, you can then scale the website running the worker, the web jobs, and that would do your scenario without affecting your website.
Exactly.
Right. And is that the recommended way to do that if you're looking for that sort of loose coupling, to basically spin up each version? That way you can kind of...
Today, that's all I think all you can do.
That's kind of the way I look at it. Now, one other thing that you can do, and I haven't figured out how to do this yet, but I've talked to Amit and Dave, and they swear they can do this. But if you have a web job deployed with your website and your website is running over multiple instances, and you have concern over your web jobs maybe arguing over, you know, message consumption, you can actually set your web job in singleton mode so that your web job will only run on one of those instances. So you can have your website fanned out over 10 instances and have your web job running in one. So if you wanted to do that, you could. But if you need that massive processing power, there's no reason to distribute that out. So.
Right.
And
the
WebJobs SDK makes it dirt simple to watch queues, watch blobs, upload stuff, and all that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in terms of is lightweight worker role an appropriate way to kind of call web jobs? Or I guess when somebody's deciding, should I go worker role or should I go web jobs, is it, because I always think of it as kind of like the lightweight version, but is there a better way for somebody to kind of make the decision on which one to go?
Think about it like this. Let's say you have a website that it saves people's email addresses to a newsletter database, and you have a console app that you run using RunAt or WinAt or some sort of scheduled thing. You could basically take that console application, you could actually build a console application in Studio, right-click it, and say deploy as Azure Web Job, and it'll create a brand new website for you and just put the web job in it. Now, that's a good example of that. Another good example that Pranav talks about a lot is image processing. I have a friend over in Sweden named Alan, and Alan does this amazing demo using worker roles where he fans out over 256 instances and does a ray tracing algorithm using a Kinect. You don't want to use web jobs for that. So you probably wouldn't want to use automation service for that either, because that's when you want the worker role scale. I mean, I like your lightweight comment, but that's not to imply that web jobs are just for lightweight processes. You can scale
them
out,
too. They're
not, yeah. Right, okay. Right.
Another
pretty powerful.
Another analogy there is a worker role, you can actually remote desktop into that VM. You can change that VM however you want, so it's highly customizable. While in the web job scenario, you're running in a managed runtime.
Right. Yeah.
And so you get a lot of benefits by being in the managed runtime. You know, we're going to take care of a lot of stuff for you, and you're not going to have to have 15-minute reboots of your virtual machine.
Right.
But you lose a little bit of control.
Yeah.
And so actually, I would say you want to use a worker role if you need full control of the machine, and you use a web job for anything else.
Yeah.
That's definitely a good point. So we have some more questions. Krister asks, can we expect WCF as a NuGet package for the core runtime? Yes, I work on a bank, and we have a lot of WCF today, but I like the idea of multiple runtimes on the same server. So you got them sold on multiple runtimes on the same server. Now it's just NuGet.
At this point, I think it's too early for us to tell. Yeah. I mean, we haven't even shipped the first version of the new runtime at all, with even our base capabilities running.
Right.
So I think we'll just, as soon as we get 1.0 out the door, we'll take a look at what it would look like to bring some of the other features over. I know there's teams that have done all kinds of ideas around, could you move WinForms over to the new small CLR? Could we move WCF over? Too early to tell. Mm. But customer feedback is what's going to drive that. So if we get lots of customer feedback.
And you said Windows Forms?
WinForms.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a hackathon on campus a couple months ago. And during that hackathon, some of the .NET team actually ported WinForms to Core CLR.
Awesome.
They ported about half of it. But yeah. they got enough to get an Othello game running.
That's awesome.
That's
so
amazing.
So in that case, awesome. It would be, you know, WinForms is a NuGet package.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, which is crazy just to think
totally.
Of that kind of separation.
Well, I love they did it at a hackathon, too. That's classic. Ravi asks, how to manage security for WCF to create public APIs? So this gets into probably some more like design questions and best practices around WCF. Do you guys feel qualified to answer that?
I don't.
I apologize. But that next question is really
important. Where is Vittorio when you need something secure?
I need Vittorio, yes.
Yeah, where is Vittorio?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's Colin. Will VS and VNext support Swagger 2.0?
This is mine.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. Not only will VS and VNext support Swagger 2.0, myself, my PM partner Guang Yang, and Mads Christensen all contributed to the Swagger 2.0 working group. We got involved with Tony Tam and Reverb and Wardnick or whoever, and we kind of helped just kind of give some ideas as to not only how we would want to use Swagger, but then when they started writing their Swagger JSON schema, Mads is really, really into JSON schema. It's one of those interesting little things that Mads has gotten tripping on recently. So he actually helped them finalize their JSON schema, and now Swagger 2.0 has just come out. Now, we're actually working with Richard Morris, the guy who wrote the Swashbuckle NuGet package. I did a show on Channel 9 with Corey about Swashbuckle a little while back. Richard, I don't put you on the spot, but Richard's working really, really hard right now, on upgrading Swashbuckle to support Swagger 2.0. So hopefully in the near future, Richard will have a new release of Swashbuckle out, and you'll be able to do Swagger 2.0. If you're using Web API right now, I highly recommend you take a look at that package, because all you do is install the package and bam, you get all the goodness of Swagger right out of the box, including the fancy UI for being able to test your APIs. Now, from the VS perspective, earlier I talked about how we really want to, you know, do something like add service reference or add web reference for REST services. What do you think the best metadata layer would be? We want to support Swagger for that. So if you actually go out to a service, we want to check and see if you have Swagger. And if you do, we want to use the Swagger metadata to figure out how to generate code. The tool that Mads mentioned earlier that he's got where we can run grunt tasks, he and I did a little bit of probably some odd experimentation where we took an NPM module that's out there in the community that will actually look at a Swagger 1.2 metadata document and generate JavaScript code with Angular for you on the fly. So I worked with Mads a little bit to learn how to write grunt tasks, because I've never written them before. Got one running and actually used Mads' tool. If you right-click it and you run that thing and you basically put in a URL, it will actually generate the JavaScript code and drop it right into your project right there. So that's one of the nice things of us basically reusing some of the grunt tasks that are already out in the community in our tooling to be able to make things run faster. But the short answer is absolutely. We're totally invested in Swagger 2.0. We want to do some partying with it.
If I have it my way, Web API will have a Swagger endpoint by default.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes.
You know, going back to the proxy and consumption, because a lot of folks, there's sort of like the people that are building, and then there's a huge, massive number of either third-party services that people are consuming, or like, you know, my goal is just basically to build, you know, clients, and those clients can be not just an ASP.NET or JavaScript, but you start thinking about, you know, a number of announcements for Cordova, or, you know, people that are building for a Windows Store, Windows Phone, that hey, our back end is this REST API, and I always have to build a manual API to consume that thing. So I love the idea, and are you all kind of thinking beyond just, you know, web to web
totally.
To client?
Absolutely. The SDK team currently has a technology we use to generate some of our Azure SDKs. And what we're trying to do is to take some of that functionality and put that into VS. I don't know if we're going to get that out in preview. It may be post-RTM before we can get this in there. But what we want to do is take some of that same code generation technology and put that in so that you could basically go from Swagger to JavaScript, or you could go from Swagger to Java, or Swagger to Node.js, or Swagger to .NET. So,
okay.
To borrow a phrase from you, if I have it my way, we would like to be able to give you the opportunity through VS to generate code that VS can't even run using VS. That'd be pretty great.
Yeah. So. I'd love to have it actually do iOS, Android, Java, JavaScript, Node,
all Python those, and PHP.
Python,
yeah.
Yeah, we do them all. And so basically, you write your back end with our technology, and then we generate the clients that you can give away to be consumed by anybody.
Yeah, and the consumption thing, the thing I'm adding, if I was a .NET developer, maybe it would give me like a client library or some equivalent. Mm-hmm. Is it the same idea, which is agnostic backend, and that backend could you do the same technology for a, let's say it's a Node REST API, or YouTube, which has a REST API, could I walk up to that API
anything
and
that anything that has a Swagger endpoint, we could do it for.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just have to give metadata to us so we know how to actually build it.
Right.
Okay. So so in that sense, it's even broader. It's
it's communicating. It's not just the .NET backend. It's like if you have a web API, not a web API, but a REST API, and you have some sort of metadata, there's a lot of flavors, RAML, YAML, Waddle, Swagger. Yeah. I'd probably go in that in reverse order there in terms of my personal favorites. But we want to support all those. We've just kind of picked our poison with Swagger out of the gate because we see so much energy behind it right now in the community.
And for folks who don't know, is there like the quick explanation of what Swagger actually is?
Yeah, Swagger is very similar in functionality to WSDL. It's basically a wire format that tells
which
you the metadata.
Which is web service description language.
Description language, pardon me. SOAP and WSDL.
From acronym to acronym.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, let's go to disco, too.
To discovery, baby.
Yeah, so basically what it is it's like that, but instead of it being this large XML blob, it's actually written in JSON. And it's a little bit easier to read. Some of the ideas that they borrowed from RAML and YAML. And those two are actually human-readable metadata languages. Okay. And the new Swagger 2.0 stuff has some really interesting capabilities that you can give it YAML, and it will hand you back Swagger. So that's pretty cool. So now if you have YAML and your consumer tells you, hey, I need Swagger, you can just go YAML to Swagger, and you'll have Swagger, and then everybody wins. So we want to basically party on that and make use of all that awesome innovation that's been going on in the API community right now. And we've already gotten dug in with the Swagger 2.0 working group. I email with Tony Tam pretty regularly to just make sure we're going in the right direction. So we want to maintain the spirit of the Swagger group as well as our
Now, I know you guys aren't authentication folks, but I think one of the other challenges is a lot of time it's this is where we need Vittorio on the panel. But the idea is that REST API, well, the first thing you need to do is authenticate with Active Directory, get a JW token and all that stuff. Is there thoughts on how to make that a client library as well? So that way you can't party on the API until you're authed.
Right.
And then how do you kind of handle that?
Well, one thing that Vittorio, you mentioned Vittorio, this week on the webcamp show again with Corey, Vittorio announced that there's a new AngularJS ADAL client. So you could actually authenticate directly against Active Directory using AngularJS. So he's thinking in that way. He's trying to get to that point. Swagger and a lot of the other ones support some of the open protocols like OAuth. I don't know if OpenID is supported, but there's a lot of different discussions on that. Quite frankly, you and I already know this. That's the most complicated part of any API design,
and definitely
of any metadata design. So that's the hard bit. So
So it looks like they're already supporting that.
They do support some, but then if you get into like custom authentication schemes or like authentication schemes that are standardized and then augmented, some of the metadata layers don't support that. So then you have to get in and write some code and do some plumbing. So
So it looks like we need to just close up. Maybe I'll do one last question.
We can do both those questions pretty fast.
Okay, so we'll do Edward Wilson. With VNext, will source code be uploaded to the server and therefore it could be changed on the fly? So you kind of answered this, but.
Yeah, we're going to let you do both. You can, if you want to upload the source code to the server so you can actually modify your app on the server, we'll fully support that. And we'll also support more of a pre-compiled mode where you actually just upload a package to the server and it just runs the packages. So we'll support both scenarios. Up to you, decide what you want to do.
Great. And Miroslav asked, will VNet support attribute routing?
And the answer is yes, it will. The first public beta that will come out will not support attribute routing. It's not going to make that beta. But it will be make the RC or the RTM release for sure.
OK, very cool. So guys, we got to close down. Thank you very much. Why don't you plug your sessions and Twitter handles so folks watching online?
I am at CoolCSH on Twitter. And tomorrow I'm doing the .NET future of .NET on the server at 8:30 in the morning.
OK, excellent.
I'm Brady Gaster on Twitter, real creative. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing a talk on the management library. So if you want to automate Azure from your .NET code, come on out. And on Friday, I'll be doing the SignalR show. I can't go to a conference without talking about SignalR. So I'll be doing the SignalR show probably Friday at like noon. So.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you both. This has been great. And thank you all for the amazing amount of questions we had. So really appreciate it. And we'll be right back real soon. Thanks.
Thanks.